Welcome to Out of Rotation, volleyball talk for players, coaches, and fans. Presented by the American Volleyball Network. Here's your host, Dan Meskin.
Hey everybody, welcome to the podcast. My guest today, University of Grand Canyon men's volleyball assistant coach Matt August, and a pretty unique podcast today. It's actually a two-parter in one. The first part that you're going to hear is actually from the end of our conversation. We were wrapping up the podcast and we started talking about Superpoint. And if you haven't been following social media or University of Louisville, we tried this thing called Superpoint in our spring match last week. And basically, each coach can call for one rally to be worth 2 points. And we had a couple different rules that go with it. If you're curious about it, just search it up on social media. And I didn't realize before chatting with Matt that he actually played in India where they created Superpoint. And so he goes through the story of what it used to be, what it is now. He was there the first year that they instituted it. They have some really, really unique rules in India for Superpoint. So that's the first part of the podcast. Then you're going to hear it transition to our normal conversation where Matt has a really unique just experience with volleyball. So a guy from the West Coast who was at a D1, then a JUCO, then found himself in the national team gym. Then he coached on the women's side, and now he's with Grand Canyon, who is one of a bunch of teams that have been ranked number one in the country for Division I men's volleyball. It's a really, really exciting men's volleyball season if you've been following it. But a really cool conversation. Again, starting out with a little bit of kind of off-the-cuff conversation about Superpoint, and then we get into Matt's story. So I hope you enjoy our conversation. Here he is, Matt August.
I wanted to ask you a question.
Yo, yeah, what?
How did it go with Superpoint?
It was awesome. So I posted the one. I've got like 8 of them. I might do a clip of each one, but we have this manager. His name's Whitman Tchaikovsky. You'll probably come across him at some point. He's like a genius. Mm-hmm. And so he, I got the idea from Jamie Gordon, who's the CEO of AVCA now. Mm-hmm. And he got it from India, obviously, which I didn't know. And he was telling me about it. I'm like, this is awesome. We have an exhibition. We can do whatever the hell we want. We could raise the net if we wanted to. So I was like, we're going to do Superpoint. And so our manager got a hold of this, and he's like so into it. He's like, this is great. So he created a graphic, a video, the song that we used. He did a light show. We just got our lights done in our gym, and it was awesome. So it was like 17. It was like 17-19, and our head coach calls for it. And like the place goes nuts. Everyone's on their feet. We win the point. It's 19 all. And so it created like more match points, which I thought was really
for sure.
Cool.
I mean, I asked because I saw that. And like, so I played in India. The first year was a thing.
So you played in it.
I did it. I did play in it. And so it was a turning point. I loved it. I thought it was so fun. Like there, you know, the train noises and the signals and all the lights and everything. But we also had, you can only call it before 11.
Yeah, that's what I like. We didn't know that. So we were like, let's do it before 20. So it's not a set point, but that was even too big. I mean, it ended the set basically.
Sets only went to 15. So that was why.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was win by one. So in pool play when I was there, it was 5 sets no matter what, all to 15, cap at 15. And super point has to be before 11.
Wow.
And then,
so that's pretty exciting, though. That makes the whole game exciting.
It was, they did such a good job of like, because they did it really for entertainment purposes, like for TV.
You wanted to be good on TV, and
they can put a time frame on it. We also had clean aces, were also worth 2 points.
Oh my God. I'm like, gotta write all this down. This is great. This is all in the India league, huh?
Yeah, this is all in India. Sweet. And I think the biggest thing was like semifinal, playoffs, it was best of 5. So we were up 2-0. In sets, semifinal, we go down 10-1. And in 4 plays, they call super point, we call super point, and we get 2 clean aces back to back.
That's sick. See, that's the stuff we need. That's sweet.
We're already only down by 1 instead of 8 points.
That's sick, man.
So I started at UC Irvine. It was close to home. I was 30 minutes from campus. I got, really connected with the coaches and just love the culture of the team. So was there, redshirted, which was my plan going in. I was still very young and needed to get more time, but I ended up having a really bad concussion in January, right when the season started, and I was out for about 5 to 6 months.
Whoa, that's gnarly. How did you get it without making a HIPAA violation here? But I'm curious if you want to share the story. How did you get a concussion that kept you out 6 months?
Yeah, so we were in practice, and I always tell myself, man, if I just didn't read the ball perfectly as a middle, I would have been fine, because I just read the, you know, center on the side, ran a big to our All-American outside hitter, 6'9", 230, just absolutely ripped, you know, outside that just can hit the ball close to 80 miles an hour. And straight up in my head, right off the, you know, the temple and everything. And when it hit the roof, came back down, hit the roof again, and I fell down, blacked out. But Jeez. Then I didn't realize I did, and just got up and acted like everything was normal. Stayed in for a play and actually got the next block. And then I was like, I landed. I was like, started to see stars and everything, a little dizzy. So went to the training room, and they were like, yeah, you're major concussion. Like, I couldn't get past any of the tests. And from there, it was just kind of like, okay, I'm fine, but I still definitely feel a little, you know, side effects of it, whatever it was. And it just kept hitting me. Like, I couldn't go to class. I couldn't focus. I couldn't, you know, be in the bright light situations. I couldn't go to our home matches. And it just kept me out for that long. So grades started to fall, because even though there was an exception and everything, it's just, I was out for so long that those things, I just can't, you know, they can't help me out anymore. So mutual agreement to take a leave. At that point, I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing, and had to figure it out very last minute that I was going to go right down the street at Irvine Valley College. The plan was to go back to Irvine, but after that, you know, UC Irvine didn't work out, and I felt like I failed and I was going to quit. Went to Irvine Valley and just kind of took a little more time for myself, but then put volleyball on the backside and just kind of wanted to focus on school and focus on, you know, just getting myself healthier and just in good mindset going, you know, going into a different environment. And I was just like, oh, it's JUCO. Like, I was just in D1. Like, this is going to be whatever. But the coach there, Tom Pestalozzi, was an amazing person that, you know, brought back my passion for volleyball and wanted me to continue this sport. But yeah, I spent 2 years there, and it was probably the best decision that probably I ever made for my own well-being and my own personal growth of this sport, and falling in love with it on a deeper level. And then that's actually how I really wanted to become a coach, was because of my coach there. It was very different between Irvine and IVC of just how they just manage their programs. And it was just very, you know, nothing. I loved Irvine. I loved David Niffen, but just a little different environment that brought something out in me.
So real quick, before we go past that, because you talked about like an impactful time, and you're bringing me back to my playing career. And I think a lot of people listening too, because we talked about like, I wanted to quit. And like, I've had that moment too. Like, I was at Ohio State and I was a backup to a backup to a backup, and I wasn't doing much. And I remember going out to Applebee's after a match with my parents, and I was like, I'm transferring, I'm leaving, I don't want to do this, and I'm going to go back. You know, I'm from Chicago, I'm going to go back to Loyola. They probably didn't even want me. But I just remember like wanting to quit. And my parents were like, and they might remember the story different, this is how I remember it. They were like, okay. And I was like, no, you're supposed to like talk me out of this. They were like, all right, you can quit. You can be a quitter. And it was like, that's all they said. And it was like this one of these things of like, it was really good self-reflection for me of like, all right, I'm not a quitter. I'm going to keep going for this. And then, you know, the rest of my career was what it was. But I remember that moment really vividly. Is there like a specific time for you where you were like, man, I wanted to quit? And then it sounds like your coach at – what was your coach's name again at Irvine Valley College?
Tom Pestalozzi.
Pestalozzi. I didn't think I could pronounce it right. That's why I asked.
No, that's okay.
But was there a specific conversation or a moment or a practice there or an interaction with him or even with somebody else that you're like, man, I was like done. I was out. Mm-hmm. And then this happened, and not only did I want to continue to do this, I knew I actually wanted to coach. Is there like a specific memory to that? Because again, when you talked through that, I was like, boom, it took me right back to that spot.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think looking back, I don't think there was just a single moment, but maybe a month or so of just collective moments, maybe like my first, you know, month, 2 months there, that it was, you know, it wasn't what I was doing at UC Irvine. I wasn't lifting 5 days in the week in the morning at 6 a.m. I wasn't then going, you know, to class all day and then coming back for practice. Like in the fall there, it was, I had two or three classes a day. I had 2 days of practice officially for the fall, and that was it. And I was just like, wow, like this is just very different. And I'm just, you know, I'm happy that I've been taking care of my classwork, but you know, this, but like I miss volleyball. And I think the big why the reason I wanted to quit maybe was just like it was just a different level, and I wasn't sure of what it was going to be like playing actually wise. Like team was actually pretty solid, but I didn't know what competition was going to be like. So I was like, oh, this is going to be easy. Like, am I really going to grow from this? But, you know, bringing back into why I wanted to continue it was this, those little moments with my coach of just like, what do I want out of this? What do I want out of this experience of being that D1 bounce back and trying to see what I wanted to do out of it. And he asked me the honest question, like, what do you want to do with volleyball? What do you want to do, you know, with your life? Like, there's no harm in leaving if that's, you know, if you wanted to quit. But like, if you stay here, I'm going to make sure that you're healthy on and off the court, and it's all going to come together. And I think that was a kind of a turning point for me. Just, you know, he's right. And like, I'll see it through for a year, and I'll reevaluate next year.
Yeah. You used a term I've never heard before, which I'm curious if there's different terms for them. So D1 bounce back. I know that the JUCOs are really high level in California. I even remember thinking like when I wasn't getting offers that I thought I could play at or whatever, I was like, maybe I'll just go to a JUCO in California. I didn't know anything about them, but I knew that a lot of great players had come from there. Is that what people still call them, or is there a name for this? I had never heard D1 bounce back. That's like somebody goes D1 but then ends up at JUCO, or what's the deal there?
That's where like, I think where I kind of first heard it, and that's why I just like label myself as, and then I've heard it a couple times more and more, and then from different, you know, actually I was watching like Last Chance of You or something like that on Netflix, and I've heard that, I was hearing that term over and over. Okay, and I was like, okay, so I was actually on to something.
Fair enough. Well, hey, as we walk through your bio though, so it's, you know, you go from Irvine Valley College, and one of the next things in your bio is time with the U.S. national team. So to me, that's a really interesting jump. And I know there's different, you know, senior national teams you can play with. Right now for the women, they got college players out there that I think are going to prepare for Norseca's, while the team that's going to go to Paris is going, you know, they're training kind of separate, but it's still the senior national team, and it's still a pipeline into a future with, I mean, the goal is to potentially play in the Olympics someday. So that's a pretty big jump there from a D1 bounce back to a little bit of time with the U.S. team. Talk to me a little bit about how that comes together.
Yeah. So I think it all started to come together with, you know, my time with the national team and in the national team gym was after my time at IBC, I was planning on transferring to University of Hawaii. And there's just some academic stuff and transferring that just didn't work out. So I was home, and that was actually the first year that they put out that this was going to be the men's open trial, like the women have every year in Colorado Springs.
Yeah, it just happened like a month ago for the women. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was the first time they were doing that for the men's in a similar fashion. And it was in Anaheim at their, you know, their facility. It wasn't as big, and I don't think they've actually done it since. But I was, you know, I got recruited to UCLA. So I had a relationship with John Sparrow and with Brad Keller at the time, who was, you know, helping out with the men's a little bit. So I saw that and I was like, I'm going to do it. And I went there, and there was a bunch of the guys that I play club with that were at those schools were, you know, in the third and fourth years that were competing for national championships. And I went, and they knew who I, you know, John remembered me, Sparrow remembered me. Rob Nielsen as well was with the men's national team at that time. And they were like, so what are you doing? Because they knew I wasn't playing in college, obviously. So like, they're like, so you're home? Or are you wanting to train? Like, what do you want to do with this? I was like, look, I just saw the opportunity to do this. There's no way I could pass it up, obviously. Like, yes, I'm home. I want to go play overseas. I'm trying to, you know, get enough footage as I can, possibly even from JUCO, like good level, but the jump from that is significant. And they're like, well, look, you're home, you know, we're happy to have you in our gym and train with the guys that are, you know, either not overseas right now and just getting in the pipeline of the national team and guys coming back from injury and then guys in those like 3 month leagues in China and Japan and those Asian countries that come back in like January, February. So I was like, perfect. And this is, you know, I was in my mind, I was like, okay, I made it. Now I can actually have that connection where I can try to go overseas. And, but just having, being in that gym for me was kind of just a self-reflecting moment of like, I'm so happy I didn't quit and I'm going to take this as far as I can now. And yeah, so I think that from, I think it was in December or January of 2019 where I was in the gym and it was guys like Thomas Jeschke, who was rehabbing at the time, but like he was in the gym. Taylor Averill was rehabbing at the time too, and he was in the gym. So getting just reps with those guys, James Shaw, like getting, being in the gym, not having any 6-on-6 play because there's only maybe 7 guys there, but getting that coaching and then getting those connections. And I just went there every single day for a couple months until probably May when those guys start, the national team guys started to come back. When I was like, okay, like you're probably just going to be on the sideline, which is fine. I want to be in the gym. I want to be a towel guy. I want to be a shagger. I just want to be in that gym. And I was for a little bit. So I got to at least, you know, do the little side drills and little breakout drills with Michael Christensen and, you know, with Max Holt and David Smith and all these top players in the world. And I was like, wow, like, this is awesome. But that summer I had enough film and I had enough people because of that time in the national team gym where they vouched for me overseas. And I was able to sign a contract with a team in Czech Republic. And then right before I left for there, Rob Nielsen called me and was like, hey, I told you to be ready. Like, we have a Norseca opportunity that we would love to for you to be a part of if you want. And I was able to be on that roster that, you know, played the A1 teams of Canada and Cuba and Puerto Rico. Our team was a bunch of guys going overseas for the first year and 2 veterans that came back and were like leading that team. But yeah, I think very long kind of story right there, but it was definitely just, it's a big switch, a big change from JUCO to that.
I believe it. And there's a moment there that I'm curious. So like you said, you know, the open tryout and like mm-hmm. the open tryouts for the women are different. There's like 3 or 4 and maybe they're not different, but your situation is different where like, it sounds like you were on your own dime on that. You're like, they're like, it's $1,000 to do it or whatever it might be. And you're like, I got to come up with this money and pay it. Where in the women's game, a lot of schools are paying all of it. So they're going to fly their girls out there. They're going to pay, you know, the registration and all that. And then there's some other schools that they're like, hey, we'll pay half. And so there's a little bit of skin in the game for the players. But for you, I would assume, since you weren't affiliated with a school, like that was all out of pocket for you, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so like the moment there where you're like, okay, I'm either going to do this open tryout and I'm going to like keep going on this, or I'm going to like go this other way. What was the other way? Like, what was the fallback? Was the fallback like, I guess I'll just kind of start coaching, or like, because for me it was construction. Like now I'm quite a bit older than you. I graduated in 2007 and I was going to do residential construction and build houses, and then the housing market burst. So I ended up falling into coaching. So for me, that was like that pivot moment. For you, you're like, I'm either going to pay this money for the open tryout or I'm going to do this. Like, what was the backup? Or was there no backup? You're like, no, I'm still doing this volleyball thing. I'm rolling.
I think it was, you know, I was just going to do it. And if it didn't work out, I don't know. And I think I was just so focused on, you know, trying to at least tell myself that I know I can play at this level and I deserve to play at this next level, just to, you know, regardless of what happened in my 3 years of college prior, that just didn't work out for me. And I just felt like I didn't amount to anything. And I was like, I just wanted to prove at least myself wrong and, you know, prove myself right that I can keep playing.
Yeah.
So
I like there was that. No fallback. That's like one of those things you try to find is, you just described internal motivation, right? There weren't these like, you know, like you had to prove it to yourself. And I always think about that with the, you know, this too, as we coach college athletes, I think men, women, it's all the same. for just athletes, it's like when you find somebody who's internally motivated, it's like, man, what you can do is crazy. When you have to constantly be externally motivating people, it's like you just kind of tap out what you can do. So I think there's, exactly. there's a reason that, you know, you went for that big from a D1 bounce back to USA, so to speak. So a little bit of pro stuff in there. You know, I want to spend a lot of time on Grand Canyon in particular, honestly. But as we go through your pro, you got a couple years of pro. And obviously COVID happens during that. It's 19 to 20, 21.
Yeah.
Any stories stick out from pro as like, you know, highlight or low light of just like this was kind of what I remember of pro? I'm just curious. I don't want to gloss over that part of your path, but I do want to make sure we get to GCU.
It was, I think overall, like it was a great experience, and it was definitely tough being gone for that long. And during the COVID, where, especially when I came back, I didn't know if I had another contract the next season. So if they were even doing another season, but the biggest thing for me is it will always be a positive takeaway regardless of time alone or time away from family. I made, you know, lifelong connections with so many of my teammates that, you know, I really just enjoyed being out there and getting to do what I really, really loved and getting paid to do it and being a professional, because it really is, you know, they run a very tight business over there and every single club is very different, but it's your job. So I know if, you know, not performing, and even, you know, from your agents, like they're going to be very honest with you. I remember one of like my worst games of my career, my agent calls me and she goes, "You might get fired." And I go, "It was one game." She's like, "No, you might get fired."
That's pretty wild.
And then 2 weeks later, she's like, "That was the best game of your career. Like, I have four contracts waiting for you because of that one game." And I was like, "You just told me a month ago I was going to get fired."
That's crazy.
And she's like, "Yeah, that's how it works."
That's the real world when they're paying you. So
yeah.
I'm bummed for the men. Now, it sounds like there might be a little bit of momentum, but we have these women's leagues are taking off. So it seems like
for sure.
The opportunity is just growing. You know, I played one season professionally in Indonesia. And I was leaving. It was the day I was leaving, and I hadn't been paid yet. And so I'm like, I'm either getting on this plane or like, what do I do here? I'm not gonna not go home. And then I got paid in cash. I don't know if I'm indicting myself, but I got paid in cash, like over what you're able to bring on an airplane. And I was like, what am I gonna do with this? I'm like, I got this wad of cash to bring home. And then I got home, and the first thing I bought was I didn't have a car at the time, or I don't know what it was, but I bought like a bike to ride around. I thought it was like a really
love
nice
that.
Bike.
Coolest thing.
That was like my big thing. What was your first purchase with like the pro money? You're actually getting paid finally. You know, you had to pay for the open tryout. You finally get paid to play. What was like the splurge purchase?
The splurge purpose, regardless of how little my contract was, I never had like. I always wanted a MacBook, and I always wanted a MacBook, and I went and got out, and there was an Apple store in Prague in Czech Republic, and I bought a MacBook, and I was like, that to me was like the coolest little thing. I was like, hell yeah.
Nice. You still rocking the same one?
I still have the same one. I do.
That's pretty cool. Like opening memories every time you open it up. Yeah, that's exactly. Sweet. Well, so then, you know, from there, you did spend some time in the women's game, right, at Denver?
Which I did.
I mean, and Denver at the time, you know, they actually just won the conference last year, I think, with a new staff. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty magical year for them, but have always been super successful. So, I mean, you were at the top of the league, may not have made deep runs the NCAA tournament as a mid-major, but obviously coaching, you know, a top-tier team, Division I.
Yes.
And then from there, you get back into the men's game. And, you know, with that, was that always kind of the plan, is to get back in the men's game? You felt drawn back to it? Did you find yourself in the women's game right away just because that's where the most jobs are and the most opportunities? I think that's kind of how I got into it.
For sure.
Talk to me a little bit about the men's versus the women's game, because I've never coached on the men's side. I've only ever been on the women's side. How did that kind of come about?
Yeah, it was not the plan, I don't think. It kind of came out of nowhere. But yeah, my time at Denver was incredible. And I was a volunteer, but Tom Hogan knew, you know, I told him, like, I want to do this as a career. Like, I want to pursue this. So he allowed me to coach. And he, you know, was an amazing mentor that took me in and taught me everything there was to know about coaching and what it really took. And it's not just showing up, going to practice, and going home. Like, there's just so many more little things. But yeah, the transition from Denver to GCU was not planned, not expected. Happened very late, where, you know, I got the job at GCU and July, early July, and I told Tom that I was coming back to be his volunteer again. But I was coaching a college coach camp for Denver. And they sent me out to Phoenix for Arizona Sky. And funny enough, I was at that camp and I knew one person in Phoenix, and it was Matt Worley, our current head coach at GCU, because he was the coach of that Norseca team that I was a part of.
Oh, nice.
He was the head coach of that, and we stayed in touch, and he was, you know, he was texting me about my pro career, and I was texting him about GCU. And he was the only person I knew in Phoenix. So I was just like, hey, I've never been to Phoenix. I'm in town. Love to catch up and get dinner and, you know, and see his wife who I've met prior. And he's like, come to the house, come to dinner. We'd love to see you. His former assistant who just got the job at Auburn. And he was about to move to Auburn, was there, and we were just talking, and he was like, do you want to do this full time? And I go, I do. Apply for my spot. And I go, okay. I didn't even know it was open. Like, I didn't know. My mind, like, he was just like, so you want to coach? I have an open position. Like, try it out. Later to find out that he knew that I was coaching, and he wanted me because he wanted to take a chance on a young coach coming in. And it was already planned, but like, for me, I was just like, okay. And a week later, I came out for an interview. He flew me out 24 hours after I got back to Denver. At the time, I was still in Denver coping with camps and everything in the summer, and he offered me the job, and I was like, obviously at that moment, I just can't turn that down. I think it's a great opportunity for me. I enjoy getting back into the men's game, but then also I was like, okay, now I'm getting paid. So it's kind of a,
that's always nice when you've been doing something for free and you finally get paid for it. But so the job part of it is really interesting, because like you said, like, you basically were on a job interview without knowing it. You're going over to his place. You don't even know the job's open. And I heard this one time, like, I remember this job, like, recommendation, or I guess they would say, like, if you aren't if you're looking at a job and you haven't been contacted for it, you don't have a great chance at it. So, like, I always remember that of, like, if you're trying to get a job and you hadn't already heard about it, why hadn't you heard about it? And, like, for you, it was your connection with Norseca. It was, you know, the fact that you guys had – he had coached you and he knew that you were in that coaching career and you had kind of kept that connection. You already had the job before the job even opened. And I think, especially for sought-after jobs, I mean, you're at a team that was ranked number one last week and is, you know, top team – for those top jobs, very rarely are they sifting through all the resumes and going, oh, I've never heard of this guy. We should hire him. Like, a lot of times they kind of have a list that they're building, and those connections that you're building that you don't know, you're kind of always interviewing for your next job. And it took me a really long time to figure that out. It would be like a job would open and I'd be like, oh, are they considering me for that job? Should I look for that job? What's going on with that job? And it was like, asking those questions, you're already behind the eight ball. Like, if you're not already in the mix for that job, you haven't done the legwork on the front end. So I think it was really interesting with your Grand Canyon getting that job. It reminds me of so many ones that I hear about. Is just, you're kind of interviewing for
that
the
makes
job.
So much sense.
Yeah, you're interviewing it all the time. Like, you're interviewing for the job way before it ever opened. And if you're just trying to get the job once it opened, you have a very, very small chance of getting it. But anyways, it just reminded me of that, because I've heard so many stories about that where it's like, I didn't even know that the job was open. And then all of a sudden I had it. And it was like, well, it's not that easy. Like, you were interviewing for that job for the years of keeping that connection and doing all that. So I thought it was interesting.
Wild.
So, but anyways, let's get into actual Grand Canyon here. Because it was when me and you first connected about getting together and doing this podcast, you guys literally just got the number one seed. And it's the first time ever in program history. When I was playing, Grand Canyon added the program, which is like crazy to me. So, you know, for Louisville, I looked at that, you guys getting number one. And for my experience at Louisville, we got here 7 years ago. And 2 years ago, we got the number one ranking at some point in the season. It was pretty cool. It was a really cool rise. Well, when we got here, we had, you know, the program prior had won national championships. There was 20 years of history. Right. There were all Americans. There were all of that. Grand Canyon did it from scratch. So, you know, clearly you weren't there for the entire build. But I'm just curious for the number one ranking. You know, you had it last week, and obviously there's a number one curse. We'll talk about that later. But to even get to that conversation, tell me a little bit about your experience hopping on for, you know, a year or two of that and just seeing the build and kind of what it meant to you as somebody who's been at a JUCO and now is coaching, you know, at a top, you know, number one team in the country for you, but then also for the program and the players that were a part of it.
Man, where do I start? I think it's, yeah, I mean, like you said, the program has been around for only 13 years, and Worley has been at least a part of the staff for the entirety of it. So he really is GCU volleyball. I think he has just done an incredible job of building a culture that kids want to be a part of, because once that happens, like, volleyball stuff will figure itself out, and, you know, we'll bring in good athletes, but he's done a great job of just bringing in good kids that want to just get better and have those chip on their shoulders and prove everybody wrong and just be like, GCU in the MPSF, that's not going to go well. It's like, they have to play UCLA and then play USC and Stanford. And then, like, you know, he's done an incredible job of just bringing kids that have that were under recruited. Even now with our number one ranking and the past success that we've had, you know, these last 2 years, like, we're still getting, you know, not the top recruits, and which is fine. Right. We're going to bring the kids that want to be here and want to create something special and want to keep proving everybody wrong and, you know, proving that we are in that conversation, regardless of if everyone doesn't think we are, even though we've had the number one. But I think being a part of it and seeing it firsthand has been awesome, just because of the kids that he brought in. Like, four of our six starters from last year and this year, who returned, three of them were walk-ons when they first came here.
Wow.
And, you know, no one, you know, the UCLAs, the USCs didn't reach out to them when they were getting recruited and committing at their senior year, and not, you know, one of those first kids that committed their September of their junior year. But it really, I think, has just been because of the culture that he has created, where these guys are best friends. These guys spend a lot of time together, and they're able to have those difficult conversations with each other that in turn, you know, helps them on the court. And I think just the connection that we really have has been so fun to watch, and proving everybody wrong. But yeah, it's been very special for me. Like you said, I wasn't a part of the foundation. But definitely very cool to see the growth of these guys and hearing about them even when I started playing.
So you talked about chip on their shoulder. And so if there's one guy who encompasses that, or his story does, or if there's something in recruiting you guys have identified that you're like, this is the type of guy, because under-recruited is a big thing. And like, we're kind of the same way, where, you know, we don't get the number one top recruit in the country every year. We have a conversation and we're in the mix, but nobody gets that player every single year. But there's certainly blue bloods. Like in your sport, you've got UCLA, right? And they'll get maybe the top three in that year. Like, that's just traditionally what's happened. But then the recruiting rankings are a snapshot in time. And when you look at an 18-year-old kid who's going to graduate and be 22 or 23, that's like 20% of their life hasn't happened yet as an athlete. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's such a small snapshot. So it's really cool to see kids grow and learn. And that chip on their shoulder is something that I've seen with success in our program too. Of like, you know, Claire Chassé is somebody I talk about a lot on the podcast, because she was very under-recruited and she ended up being a first-team All-American. She's playing in PVF, one of the best players. But her growth from freshman to senior year is maybe the most I've ever seen. But it's like, that was 50% of her volleyball career. She hadn't played all of her volleyball yet. So, you know, I don't know how we like identified that. Like, it's really hard sometimes. But what do you guys have, or what's the special sauce of like, this is the type of guy we like? Or, you know, if it's easier, like, this guy really encompasses what's really been successful here. Like, this guy's got a chip on his shoulder and he's really having great success now.
I think, for an example of one of those guys is our opposite right now. He's a sixth year, Camden Gianni. He's told me this story so many times. His, you know, senior of high school, he was a very talented club player, little undersized for the opposite position, especially looking at like the next level and the arm that is required at the next level at the opposite position. He emailed every single school in the MPSF minus GCU.
What a burn.
And it came to the point where every single one of those schools said no. And Worley has a very good connection with Wave Volleyball Club, where he played. And it was very late in his senior year. He's like, look, I appreciate your style of play. I love it. You have that chip. You have that edge. You kind of like, you trash talk a little bit. And like, that's fine for a little bit here and there in practice gym. Like, look, like, I think you're going to be a great fit. Like, it's up to you. I know you're going to be a very, you know, consistent volleyball player, is what he told him. And he was like, that's my only option. And, you know, I trusted him, so I took a chance on him. But it's those GCU has been that program where it's those guys that don't commit until, you know, the January, February of their senior year that maybe are a little undersized. You know, in our starting lineup, we don't have one player over 6'6".
I was looking at your roster. You got 1'6", 10 guy, but he's from Texas. So that's obviously like, that's not exactly a hotbed for volleyball where you're getting your height. Yeah. You're not getting the California 7-footers. But this guy you were talking about too, Gianni, opposite wearing number one. I wore number one. I played opposite. I like this guy already. This is crazy though. I just pulled up his bio as you were chatting through, because I don't know the men's game. I've never heard of this dude. Mm-hmm. I've definitely seen him play on volumetrics, but I always know numbers. I don't know names because I'm just watching to learn the game. But in 2019, went down with this is on his bio, went down with a medical emergency and received life-saving support. You want to talk about, and now he's in his sixth year. Like, that's a pretty sweet story by this guy. This is pretty awesome. So, and then his freshman year, he was second-team All-American and all that. So, I mean, you guys really struck gold with that. But you said undersized. He's listed at 6'5". I mean, that's kind of undersized in the men's game now, huh?
Especially in the men's game, I think. You know, you're getting these kids, especially with how big international recruiting is in the men's game more so now. Like, he is a very undersized opposite. Like, all of our opposites, I think, minus one on the men's game in our conference, at least, they're 6'7", 6'8", with the jumping ability and with the arms. So it's like he just has to adapt. But he's very explosive. He's smart. And he just hits living out of the ball.
That goes a long way. Do you guys ever measure that? This just made me think of this when you talk about how hard he hits. Do you guys ever measure like attack velocity? I know in the men's game, it's all about serve and where the serve should be at. Do you ever do how hard they're hitting attacking, or is it the same on serving? Cause that's something we've been kind of messing with here is, again, I'll bring up Claire Chassé. We measured it for, it was a couple years ago, but this was before she was a starter, and she measured like 5 miles per hour higher than everybody. She was our hardest hitter. Mm-hmm. And you could kind of see it, but you would never, there wasn't anything to conceptualize it. And it was really interesting that she ended up being a first team All-American. So we're like, maybe we should measure spike velocity and make sure it's going up. Do they do that in the men's game, or is it all about serve?
I think more so it's about the serve. Maybe not actually attacking velocity, but
so what do you guys tap out at serving wise? Like, you got somebody and you're like, hey, we're trying to win the national championship. We need your serve to be at this.
I think Cannon Gianni, for an example, again, his top right now is about 76 miles an hour.
Jeez.
And we have guys, I think he's our toughest in our gym, but there's guys, University of Hawaii, there's a little kid, and he's literally, I say little, he's about 6 foot, but he jumps about 50 inches and serves the ball at, I think he broke a NCAA record of 82 miles an hour.
Wow.
Or 81.
That's unreal. Now, are those like, I played so long ago. There was some guys like Clay Stanley played when he was kind of like an Olympian. He was Olympic national team when I was kind of in college, but he was the gold standard for how hard someone hit. And then he hit so hard that it actually didn't have like true spin at some point. Like, is that happening? Is that happening with these guys that are hitting that hard, or are they getting the true spin on it?
It's not happening. If they do, it's obviously not that fast.
Yeah.
Camden serve, he side spins it and then he just hits and it turns into like a little just junk
little bit of
floater with some side spin. But maybe not true top spin with all these guys, but there's some hard hitting boys out here for sure.
Fair enough. Well, like I said, I don't follow the men's game like tooth and nail. I get some updates on my phone and I'll tune into a match here and there, but give me a quick snapshot of the men's game right now for GCU, what you guys are looking at in conference, and then what it's going to take. You guys were ranked number one. This seems like one of those years where it's like I've seen 10 teams ranked number one. It's like literally anyone can win the national championship. So for you guys in particular, what's the season look like at this point here, and what's it got to do going forward for you guys to be the last one standing at the end of the year?
Yeah, I think, obviously we had a great start to the year. And I think the best part about this game is like it's awesome to kind of see how we respond in after a tough weekend, and we just are very strong together as a team, and I think we know what we need to work on. We know what we need to do. You know, yeah, we've lost the number one ranking. There's the par, like I said, I think earlier, like the parity of the competition level of this season. Like anybody can win the national championship, and I think we're taking that to heart. We're not just kind of just saying it. Like we know at any given night, anyone can beat anyone, and our record is 0-0 every single week. We don't care about the rankings. Number one was cool. It was awesome for the program. But, you know, we really didn't care in terms of what it like. Oh, yeah, we're number one. Now we can just coast. You know, our mentality is we're going to be 1-0 every single game the rest of the season, because we know that if we just come in with that mentality every single night, no one can beat us. And, you know, we're going to take that as far as possible. And I think we just need to be a little bit more consistent in a couple areas, especially with the men's game. Like just serve and pass game is just so important. So taking care of those reps and those times in the practice gym are just definitely going to get us where we want to be, and which is, you know, in Long Beach, May 4th with the national championship.
Thanks for listening to Out of Rotation with your host, Dan Meske, presented by the American Volleyball Network. Until next time, come on, don't give them any free points. Always stay in rotation.